Emma.
I'm Kiana.
I'm Tanasia.
I'm Lila.
And I'm Badila. And we're
the Perfect 10 After School. And we love to be a part of WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM, celebrating creative community radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, heard weekday mornings here at 8 o'clock on WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC is hosting its pledge drive, and we need your support. Help keep hands-on creative community radio alive in your region by calling 518-697-7400. That's 518-697-7400, or you can pledge online with your tax-deductible pledge at wgxc.org/donate. That's wgxc.org/donate. Help WGXC meet its goal and keep local, national, and international news broadcasting in Greene and Columbia counties. Thanks so much.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Gina Martin of Athens, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in green and
found me down here in my hell, know me better than I know myself. Still you think I'm good? Not put off by this life of sin, not fooled by this animal skin. I've been hiding in the wood and the cool mountain springs from your bright wings.
I should just ask you.
Good evening. Welcome to Foraging Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor in the studio with Ben Hale.
Hello.
And our special guest today, singer, songwriter, lieutenant commander, and Navy pilot, Brett Williams. Welcome, Brett.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking with Brett about his career in the Navy, which spanned 20 years.
That's right? Correct.
And listen to some of your music and maybe learn a little bit about your process and your very interesting journey from where you are and from where you came from. Yeah. So you do not strike, except for the tattoos and hulking presence, you do not strike me as like, oh, definitely a Navy guy. What could you talk a little bit about your journey from like high school quickly to like how you got yourself into the Navy and then became a pilot.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because I think that before I joined the Navy, I would have shared your thoughts, and I thought I knew what a Navy guy looked like. And what I discovered in the military is that I grew up in sort of liberal circles, despite my father having served in Vietnam. We didn't have any friends that were military. We didn't have any, there wasn't any family that was in the military. And if you would ask me as a kid to draw a picture of a Navy guy, I probably would not, like you're saying, I would not have drawn myself. I would have had this kind of idea of like a jarhead type.
Right.
You know. But what I discovered, particularly among aviation in the military, is that it attracts a range of interesting personalities. And I was, I think, one of my happiest discoveries in the military was how much naval aviation culture seems to be supportive of people's creativity and their other interests.
Really?
Yeah. There's very much a crowd of creative types and scholars and people that are interested in a great many things, because I think flying attracts people. Maybe they would not have gone into the military for another reason, but the desire to fly, and particularly to fly those kinds of aircraft, which very few people get to do, maybe draws in all kinds of romantic types.
But before you went to the Navy, you studied. You went to the School of Dramatic Arts.
Right. When I left high school, I wanted to be an actor.
Right.
Or so I thought. And then I discovered that was actually work. And I wasn't automatically sent to Hollywood to star in feature films.
That's funny how that works.
Yeah. After trying that for about a year and realizing that I wasn't particularly good at it, nor did I have an all-consuming passion for it, I thought, well, I should probably try to do something a little more responsible. And so I went back to college to get a chemistry degree.
And you went to SUNY Purchase.
Right.
You got a chemistry degree. So you went from acting to chemistry, and you studied chemistry, and you thought, this is for me?
I did like it. Mm-hmm. I've always liked sciences. But as I progressed, and I ended up transferring to Stony Brook, because some of the listeners in this area might already know that Purchase began to focus more on their original mission as an art school, and they closed down the physics department, and the writing was on the wall for science students at Purchase, though I think it still thrives in some respects. So I transferred to one of the big university centers, the Stony Brook,
finished your degree in chemistry. You liked chemistry and then you got out of college with a
bachelor's in chemistry.
That's a very marketable degree.
I think so.
Degree.
Yeah, and I did. I interviewed with Pfizer and Pepsi and places like that. But I had already discovered two things. One was that I wanted to fly in the Navy, and the other was that my interests in chemistry were less practical than what Pfizer or Pepsi or Dow would want you to focus on. I was more interested in the physics. And the mathematics, and so later, years later, when I ended up in grad school, it was for physics. So,
How does one find out that one wants to fly Navy planes
It sounded
aircraft.
Like an adventure. I thought
right.
it sounded impressive. I thought I wouldn't have to prove myself mm-hmm. ever again if I do this. And I think the influence of my father. It's hard to reckon, I think it may have been inevitable that I...
Was he a Navy pilot?
He was a Navy pilot, yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Did you consider the Air Force at all?
If I had joined the Air Force, it would have cost me my relationship with my father.
the rivalry between the Navy and the Air Force is really that...
No, he would have been just as thrilled, but that's... I'm mostly joking, but I think he was very pleased when I decided to go naval aviation. So that was good.
So then you decide you want to fly planes. You want to, be a Navy pilot.
Right.
And, so then what's your next step? You already have a college degree, so you're not going to join like the enlisted. You're not going to enlist,
right? No, the Navy has three pathways to a commission as an officer. One is the Naval Academy, mm-hmm. The most sort of prestigious way to
Annapolis, right?
One is ROTC, which many four-year colleges in America have a ROTC unit associated
with them.
That's
ROTC, right. And, Reserve Officer Training Corps.
Right. And then the third way, the way I did it, was the way that Richard Gere did it in an Officer and a Gentleman, right. Which is to go to OCS, Officer Candidate School.
Officer Candidate School. Yeah. And you went to Richard Gere School.
Right. I think it had when they made that film, I think it was in Whidbey Island in Washington State. Mm-hmm. By the time I went, it was in Pensacola, Florida.
All right.
So that's where I went. And that's a 13-week training program for people who already have somehow figured out a way to get their own bachelor degree. In my case, I did college in a fairly normal way in New York with Stafford loans and work study mm-hmm. and waiting tables and things like that.
Right.
So,
and well, did the Navy then take care of that, or do you still have to pay those back?
No. If you going to OCS doesn't give you any kind of money for college. Mm. So, like many people, I was 33 when I paid off my college loans.
Wow. So. Good. Just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It's a quick course, like 13 weeks.
13 weeks for most. If you fail an inspection, which I did, it can extend to 15 weeks. So I failed an inspection in my ninth week, which is an evolution where you're standing in a room with your three closest friends in your uniform with everything perfectly cleaned and your rifle cleaned and everything laid out perfectly, and four enormous drill instructors rush into the room and start screaming abusive language at you and tearing apart everything that you prepared.
Oh, it sounds like home.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And finding things wrong, like you didn't iron this correctly, or this rifle is not cleaned perfectly. And
why do you have a rifle in the Navy?
A big part of the training is called drill, mm. where you march around with rifles and do different motions. And the idea, and I'm certain there's other things you could do to imbue this in people, but it's a way for a group of 40 people to begin to act as one, because it's very salient when if you all have to do a motion with the rifle, like present arms or mm-hmm. About face and things like that. If someone is off,
everyone's
immediately obvious to everybody,
right?
And
mm-hmm.
and so that it's not because they think we're actually going to, especially as pilots, be marching onto a battlefield with rifles, but it is a very effective way to get a group of people to start to sort of think as one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you failed inspection.
Right.
You failed inspection, your first inspection.
It was my second.
You passed the first one. And you failed the second one. And
do you remember why you failed it?
I failed it because of these things that were called, a colloquialism that they use in the Navy is called Irish pennants, mm-hmm. which is if you notice on like the buttonholes of your shirts or maybe the bottom of your shirt, you'll find very often little threads that stick out.
Mm-hmm.
And that you're not meant to have any of those on your uniform. So
huh.
people, by lamplight under their covers in the middle of the night are going over all their uniforms mm-hmm. with nail clippers and mm-hmm. And clipping these off. And and I had an extraneous amount of Irish pennants on my clothes.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that was embarrassing. So that cost me 2 weeks. I had to roll back to the class behind me. And,
whoa.
And I did 15 weeks in OCS.
Because you had a few threads loose.
Yes.
Wow.
They picked up on that.
Mm-hmm. And then at what point do you then stop judging other people for their threads that are loose?
I think when you first come out of it's very easy to see people. It's very easy to spot people that first come out of OCS because they are very critical of people's uniforms and stuff that matters a little bit less and less as you go on in the Navy. I remember seeing a captain, which is, at the time, just after commissioning, that was a very high rank to me, and seeing that he had, he had threads on his rank insignia on his sleeve, and I thought, oh, what's wrong with this guy? And then, little did I know.
Right. Takes a while. Takes a while. I just want to say that we are in our Open Ears pledge drive, so we're trying to raise money for this fantastic station that allows us to sit and sometimes just me and Ben schmooze. Sometimes we have guests such as yourself, and it's a privilege and an honor to be able to do this. And we need people's support and sustaining support. So you could give us a call at 518-697-7400 and pledge that way. Or you could just go to our website, wgxe.org/donate. That's D-O-N-A-T-E. Mm-hmm. And think about, you know, like $5 a month, $10 a month. You know, that's not even a latte, right? A month that you could give up. And you probably don't even have to give it up, right? But I just needed to make that pitch, and we'll be back with Brett Williams in a moment. We're back with Brett Williams. Sorry. And he's telling us about going to Richard Gere School. Much better looking than Richard Gere, I'll say. But
is it Gere? I thought it was Gere with a hard G. But
I don't know. But maybe we'll do that on another show.
Right. you're in the Navy for 20 years.
That's right.
Where all were you stationed?
I was stationed initially in Pensacola. Mm-hmm. After which I moved to Texas, and then I'll try not to double back because I ended up going back to certain places. But I was stationed in Texas, San Diego, Guam. Naples, Italy, Jebel, Saudi Arabia, Colombo, Sri Lanka, Mali and the Maldives, and I think I may have missed something here or there. But Monterey, California, Washington D.C. Some of the obvious places everybody goes.
What was your favorite of all these places to be?
Well, each one had its own thing that was my favorite. I think it would be hard to compare any experience overall to Naples. I was in Naples two tours, 7 years in Naples, and it's such an amazing city, there's a lot to say about Naples.
Right. Well, I was hoping you'd tell that story about coming to Naples after being in Saudi Arabia.
Right. Yeah. That was my second tour, and I had spent a year and a half in Saudi. And the thing about Saudi social life, outside the compounds that the Americans and the Brits live on, is that if you're not Muslim, it's very difficult to have a robust social life because the real action in terms of social, like hanging out with your buddies, centers around the mosque and centers around those experiences, and on the street, what's very evident when you first walk down the street in a city in Saudi Arabia is there's no girls. You don't see any girls. And you don't hear any music. You hear the call to prayer, which is interesting because it can be very beautiful. And they have a contest every year. I think it's in Egypt for people to do this call to prayer.
Huh.
And I think every year a Saudi wins it.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's one of their things because I'm sure you've heard it. And it can be very melodic.
Interesting.
And
I didn't know that they had this contest. It was a muezzin.
Muezzin.
Muezzin. Oh, yeah. You have a muezzin off.
I think so. Yeah, it's something I heard.
Wow.
But to your point, you walk down the street and it's under the hot baking sun and it's got the Middle Eastern architecture and there's a kind of emptiness that you feel and you're in the desert and you don't see women. And you don't hear popular music
or any music,
any music really. Mm-hmm. Although that has changed a little since I've been there. Mm-hmm. And so I left that after a year and a half of that. I landed in Naples, and I remember my first day walking out into the streets in downtown Naples and seeing a young couple leaning against a wall making out, and then I saw a girl in a sort of a skimpy linen top playing a harp in the middle of the square in a Piazza Gesù in downtown Naples, and I thought, the contrast was very striking,
right?
Yeah, yeah, that was profound.
Mm-hmm. So how did you? How did you entertain yourself? Not that it's impossible to entertain yourself without booze and women, but you think like for for a Navy person or a, or so, I mean, military, I mean, that's sort of the classic form of, you know, like entertainment. And I mean, and right. And how about the women that were stationed with you? Were there women stationed with you as well?
There were no women in my detachment. In the main base in Riyadh, there were women. But I will, this is something that's interesting to point out about the Saudis. We had an event there where five U.S. ships pulled into the port at Jebel, and one of the COs of one of the Coast Guard cutters was female. And we weren't sure, diplomatically, we weren't sure how our colleagues there were going to react, because they had this schedule of events, and they would go to this thing, and then that meeting, and then that dinner, et cetera, where women, Saudi women, absolutely would not be permitted.
Huh.
And I forget. I wish I could remember the name of the young CEO. She was very impressive. They were amazing with her. They just treated her like one of the guys. And they, all these places where probably no woman has ever set foot, they took her and they just referred to her. Oh yeah, the CEO of the cutter. You know, they never made any big deal about it. They're really, really gracious.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I think that had to do with the fact that there was a woman from like another culture, from another country.
They do say that in some places in the Arab world that a Western female is treated almost like a third gender.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Huh. So it's interesting. But they were incredibly gracious hosts, and I think some of that can be credited in the Eastern Province too. There's a big American influence. I don't want to take anything away from them because they're just good guys. But all of the helicopter pilots I worked with in the Eastern Province had all been educated in Pensacola. We trained the Saudi pilots, helicopter pilots in America, and they were all deeply nostalgic for their years in Florida. For all intents and purposes, that squadron in Jebel felt like an American squadron.
Interesting.
And that's part of what I ended up doing mostly in the Navy was security assistance. And that's one of the big goals is the more guys that we bring and train with us and the more guys that go to American graduate schools or American, we send them to jump school in Texas or things like that, the more our culture, our military culture permeates theirs. And it helps us, you know, work alongside them.
So do you think that the Saudi army or the Saudi military will be in sort of the vanguard of civil rights in a way the military has in many ways in this country?
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you acknowledge that. I guess I like to think that as a Navy guy that the Navy has been, the American Navy has been pretty progressive, maybe out of need.
Well, I mean, the armed forces, they integrated long before the rest of the, not long, but before the rest of the country did, certainly.
Yeah.
And had women serving and they just, you get the sense that they just didn't want to deal with the whole gay LGBT issue so long as these people, what did Bill Hicks say?
Anyone dumb enough to want to join the military should be allowed.
Right. which is ironic because most people think of the military as an incredibly conservative institution, and I think it sounds like in many ways it was. But do you think that culture, that is going to be transferable, or is that stuff just so ingrained in Saudi thought and culture that
I think they're dealing with a different dynamic. Both I remember having this conversation both in Saudi and in Sri Lanka. I remember asking Sinhalese officers in Sri Lanka, you know, hey, would you care if a guy in your unit was Tamil, you know, ethnically Tamil? And for the most part, they were like, no, you know, we don't care. We do, you know, that's why we do security checks. That's why we do background checks. That's, you know, we don't judge him because he's got Tamil chromosomes. And I had similar conversations in Saudi Arabia asking, hey, how do you feel about the guy, you know, if there's a Shia guy versus a Sunni guy in your unit? And they were like, we don't care. You know, they're not relying on those prejudices to govern, you know, how they run their ship. They're relying on things like background checks and you know, the same thing we do. I think that, so, you know, to come full circle, there's the notion in the American military that, well, you know, whatever your sexual preference is or whatever your race is or whatever your gender is, what we really care about is your competence.
Sorry, one more question about Saudi. So Saudi Arabia is just fascinating to me.
It is.
And you don't have to answer this if you don't want, but so a lot of these guys that you trained, probably no doubt, are bombing and strafing in Yemen.
I don't know. Yeah. That wasn't part of
you were before that, obviously.
Well, I think the conflict was ongoing while I was there, but that wasn't the unit that I worked with was a maritime unit.
Oh, okay.
And the arms sale that was going on at the time was for the SH-60 Romeo, which is a mine hunting ship, a mine hunting helicopter.
Oh,
excuse me, a submarine hunting helicopter. And so that these guys were training towards a completely different mission, had nothing to do with the land war going on at the border in Yemen.
Who in the Middle East has got submarines?
Well, that's a good question. the answer is nobody, I don't think. Well, I think Morocco may have a couple. That arms sale, I think they found that package that comes with that helicopter was going to be useful for a wide variety of missions.
Okay.
And they have obviously a huge maritime element to their strategic situation with Iran directly across the Gulf.
Right.
So,
And did you get into conversations about Iran with anybody?
Not directly. I mean, again, you know, I had those conversations about what sort of the place was in Saudi Arabia for Shia culture, and many Shias that you would meet in Saudi Arabia and in Bahrain looked Iranian. They had the mm-hmm. same sort of features of Iranians, because that predominantly that
ethnically different people.
Yeah. But about Saudi Iran conflict and politics, no real discussions about that.
I imagine it's something you would want to avoid.
Yeah, we walk in security assistance. I think it's good because it's a good field to be in the military, because everything is on the table. You know, it's all about training together, or them buying our weapons that are made by American industry, or about building the relationship to a point where, well, when there is a big conflict someday, if one of our squadrons is flying alongside a Saudi squadron, we know what they're doing. They know what we're doing. We don't have to explain to them how we do this or how we do that. And that the culture, there's an emulsifying effect of doing these security assistance gigs.
All right. So can you help me play another one of your songs?
Okay.
I love just the contrast between your career in the Navy and your avocation as a troubadour.
Right.
So we're going to play up a little song. It's called Inski. Is that?
It's actually called I called it the Friendship Street Inn, which is this was based on just after retiring, which I only retired a few months ago.
And I should say you are, you are in your. Yeah, 47, 48, 49, 50, up to 55 is mid-40.
Right.
That's what I'm thinking. So we're gonna play Inn on Friendship Street.
The Friendship Street Inn, and it was based on just after retiring, I stayed at a bed and breakfast not too far from here, and
in Tivoli, New York.
In Tivoli, and I was writing. The song is me talking to a few of my friends who are still in the military and telling them the adventures I was having now that I'm a civilian and staying in this. It's kind of a wild place there. A lot of it. Characters.
Is the FCC going to get us in trouble if we play this song?
No, there's no
no expletives.
There aren't. I don't think there's anything too bad in there. There's some Russian and French.
Okay,
there.
That's fine. Okay. Nobody talks that.
Dear Kyle, come round, there are paintings here. These quarters are strewn with the colors of others who've passed. Each canvas more torn from the breast than the last. There are some that glide o'er the unconscious, and others that hold the eye fast. Dreams arrive in vast, inexhaustible tranches. Thank you. Dear Jeffrey, come round, there are songs here. Her double stops last, the breath from your lungs and a gasp. Her delicate warblings too tender by half. Had the lamb heard the music they made, he'd say, it's a bit off the path. But my friend, I can see why you stay here. Dear Philip, come round, there are words here. In Russian and French, mostly dead lovers spurned. Some are written in love, exits out of hell earned. Others are written in vengeance, and not so much written as burned. Giving turn by turn directions to hell's entrance.
So, love to play the whole thing, but we got so much more to talk about.
When did you start recording these, writing and recording these songs?
Well, I started songwriting on my 17th birthday when my father he sent me an electric guitar, and I got it on my birthday, and I started playing it, and I think I wrote a song that day, which is a pretty great song, and
Do you remember that song?
I do remember that song. I actually do think it's... I do like it.
Is it titled... It's a pretty great song?
Well, it's titled, predictably, Beautiful Girl. In the home recording started in 2004. I was stationed in Monterey. And though I had continued to play and write songs since I joined the Navy in 1998... Mm-hmm. I had very quickly discovered that Navy lifestyle is difficult. It's difficult to put a band together.
Right.
And I would much, much rather.
I mean, they already got one, right?
Right. They do. They do have a very strong music program. But especially being a pilot, I was in hotel rooms and I was in all these random places all the time on the ships. And about that time, 2004, the home recording technology had gone from where, you know, like you would need the equipment that fits in this room here in the radio station to basically all you needed was a laptop and a set of headphones. So I studied up and learned how to do multi-track recording. So from 2004, I just started making my own demos of the songs not with any sense that they would remotely be radio ready. So
no,
I hope I didn't. I hope that my technique didn't blow any of your circuits.
Low standards here. Yeah, and you've exceeded them.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well exceeded.
Well exceeded. Yes. But that's all you on that.
Right. I do collaborate sometimes with people online, which is another great thing about contemporary songwriting is that there's a girl that I've done a collaboration with in England whom I've never met.
Really?
Because it's easy to just transfer files between to each other. But that one that you heard, I'm playing the guitar and I'm singing all the parts. That song was an attempt at a French thing called a chaconne, which I don't know if I'm saying it right, but it's a kind of a melody that continues to weave it into itself with multiple voices and double over itself. It wasn't very successful in maintaining that form. It became sort of just a folk song, but I did all the parts and I tried to sort of use kind of like in a Seth MacFarlane kind of way, use different characters so that my voice would have different qualities in the.
I'm fascinated with how you actually leveraged your singer-songwriting to advance your career in the Navy, which was so bizarre to me because you were just, you know, like flying helicopters, saving people at sea, you know, search and rescue, in Guam or out in the, you know, other place where there's lots of water. And
that was a big concern of mine. I think any of your listeners who know about the military will know that having retired as a lieutenant commander, whatever whatever positive effect my songwriting had, it had a limited effect. But
let's talk that. So you said you retired as a lieutenant commander.
Correct.
Like, yeah. To me, that sounds, does that sound impressive to you, Ben?
Well, a lieutenant commander is that where exactly? I'm not sure where exactly in the military hierarchy.
It's like a major.
A major, because it's different in different branches.
Right, yeah. It's the fourth rank of being an officer.
Uh-huh.
It's one could never really consider it it's not what I would call a terribly impressive career.
I have no rank.
I'd have no idea.
Well, considering where I started, now if a guy started as a seaman, you know, started enlisted, mm-hmm. And then went to university while he was still in the service, and then went into an officer program, etc., then yeah, retiring at any rank, there's nothing to be ashamed of. But considering that I started as an officer, maybe I could have gone a little bit further, but I think I did as well as I could. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So, even though you feel like a failure, you went from flying to other areas.
Yes, midway through my career, I became what's called a foreign area officer, which is kind of a diplomat in uniform, mm-hmm. and
would that be an attaché?
Well, the attachés are one half of it. The other half is security assistance, which is what I did, which is selling weapons and training to our partners. So, that decision mid career to make that move I had gone as far as I could as a pilot.
Right.
The helicopter I flew had been retired.
Uh-huh.
And I was teaching at the Naval Academy at the time. I wasn't exactly, uh-huh. Forward.
Right.
I wasn't doing the things that one needs to do to have a stellar flying career.
Right.
And the FAO community, the foreign area officer community, was being advertised for people that had an interest in foreign cultures, that had a aptitude for foreign languages.
Uh-huh.
And since I had lived overseas even before I joined the Navy, and since I felt like maybe I could contribute something.
Do you have an aptitude for foreign languages?
So I took the D-Lab, which is the Navy's test, and I got a very high score on it.
Uh-huh.
But now that I'm in my 40s, I would have to say that.
Well, you learned Italian, right?
I did. I lived there for 7 years, though. Uh-huh. So, But I think when I was younger, we lived in China when I was growing up, and I think I had a decent ear for languages. But I found that when you're in your 40s, those parts of the brain that need to be fluid for language learning tend to ossify.
Right.
I find it much more difficult now.
Yeah. Did you learn any Arabic?
I learned a little bit of Arabic, I think that was the fourth country I lived in. At that point, I was a little weary of learning new languages. I did buy the books, and I did get a tutor, and I studied as much as I could. But
can you read Arabic? Like, if you
Now I can't really read it. I can see what it says, though. I know what the sounds are, which is actually, I would recommend to anyone that trying to do a foreign language, if you're just going to study something on the plane, if you're going to a country where the writing system is different, rather than study hello and where's the hotel, learn the letters, because it helps when you walk around in a city with all these strange squiggles to not see them as squiggles anymore. To actually, even if you can't figure out what the word means, it helps to... you don't have that feeling of, you have all these alien.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. I remember when I was in St. Petersburg walking around, I was like, oh, I'm illiterate. I'm not only do I not, I am illiterate.
This is what it feels like to be illiterate.
No, exactly. You're like, I can't even, and you're just looking at, like, does this picture match this picture? Is this the street? I have no idea. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Do you speak English?
Yeah. Yeah, no, studying the writing system, I think, is really valuable. Just for that experience of just walking down the street and seeing that says something. It's not just an abstract.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to the singing and the and the music. So you used it interesting. I mean, this is just this hobby of yours,
right.
or a vocation.
I always think of it as a hobby.
Well, yeah. But mm-hmm. you spend more time on that than most people do on their hobbies.
Okay, yeah, I do.
and you work at it as a craft, as people who have heard these songs can attest.
Yeah, I am after that, writing that perfect song. I do care about that as a goal, mm-hmm. and so I try to learn more and I try to get better.
I find it kind of interesting that you said that your father gave you a guitar for your birthday when you were 17.
Yeah.
And you wrote a song the very first day that you got the guitar.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like most people who are did you know how to play a guitar?
No, no, I had a book. It was a book for a classical guitar, so that wasn't uh-huh. wasn't terribly helpful. But when I say first day I had it, that day mm-hmm. may have lasted 70 hours because I was so chuffed that I had this thing. You know, I was uh-huh. really excited about.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that most people learning to play an instrument, you know, you would start with trying to play someone else's songs or whatever.
And I did that too.
Playing scales, but your instinct to try to make a piece of art with this thing the very first day that you had it before you even learn how to play it. It's interesting.
No, I think I am a born songwriter. I think that's not to say that I'm a born good songwriter. I think that some of my memories that are connected to that. I remember precisely where I was and precisely the car I was when mm-hmm. when I first heard The Gambler, mm-hmm. Recorded by Kenny Rogers, and
right.
I remember. Not even being able to articulate. I was trying to tell my mother that I was interested in the song, but what was interesting to me was how, and if you know the song, you know, it really is incredibly well-crafted song, and the, uh-huh. and the rhyme and the construction of the verses in particular, uh-huh. everyone knows the chorus. The chorus right. is very famous, but the verses are just so, the efficiency of the, mm-hmm. of the images and the way that the rhyme is put together. And I think that's what attracted me, but I was only 4 years old or whatever, so I didn't uh-huh. I didn't really understand, you know, and that kept happening through the years. Before I got the guitar at 17, I would hear songs and I was interested in them, but I didn't know what that meant, that mm-hmm. I was interested in them, you know, because
right.
it was more than just wanting to, oh, I like this song, I want to hear it. Mm-hmm. I was studying it somehow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. interesting. Okay. I just the other day I read this interesting article about the pianist Sviatoslav Richter. I don't know much about classical piano. I hadn't heard of this guy, but apparently Richter and Glenn Gould were considered like the two greatest classical pianists of the 20th century, and they were about the same age and they knew each other. But Glenn Gould was he quit playing in the middle of his career. Famously, quit playing concerts and just concentrated on his studio albums, whereas Richter was the opposite in that that he hated playing in the studio, but he loved playing concerts. And Glenn Gould was really, really fussy about his studio recordings. He wanted the recording to be absolutely a perfect piece of music, whereas Richter didn't care. He didn't even care about the studio. He was just interested in playing, which is why he loved playing live so much more, you know. And it was about this difference of two different approaches to music, you know. And it sounds like you say with the it became so much cheaper in like the aughts to record. To make recordings of your music, that you're really interested in that Glenn Gould like product. Mm-hmm.
You're Gouldish.
Mm-hmm. I understand why you say that, and I consider that that's not my favorite part of myself, I guess, because uh-huh. It is, once you have that capability and you can, you know, now with my laptop, I can create a symphony, or I can have, you mm-hmm. know, the sound of planets colliding, or, you know, anything that I dream right. of, I can now create. But I try to remember, because it's very tempting to use all that stuff, but I try to remember, and I think this is what this bespeaks, I don't know if I'm using that word the right way, but my allegiance to folk music, which mm-hmm. is that the perfect song mm-hmm. can be stripped of all that stuff and can be sung a cappella in a yeah. hallway. Uh-huh. And it's a great song,
right?
And if you're not aiming towards that as a songwriter, and it doesn't mean every song has to be an ambition towards that, but mm-hmm. But that I try to focus more on that, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it shouldn't need a French horn in the right. B section to be interesting.
Right.
But in pop music, obviously, that's tough. We the other day we were talking about we were talking about Jerry Rafferty, Baker mm-hmm. Street. Without that sax solo, there's no song. That's mm-hmm. the, it is. So that I think there's all this gray area that you know, the song, does the song exist mm-hmm. when it's not being played, or does this, you know, if you just give someone the sheet music and say, okay, here's my song,
right,
and that sax solo is written there, and uh-huh. they can see the notes, okay, well, there it is. But in terms of enjoying it, mm-hmm. that you can't sing Baker Street in a hallway. Well, right. you can. It's actually still pretty good, but you uh-huh. you don't have that sax solo.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if that was a very... Yeah, that made, I don't know if I put that thought together very cogently, but...
No, it's cogent enough. Cogent enough. So we're going to take another short musical interlude. We're going to listen to Selección.
Which
is about you getting chosen for the Grammys?
This is when I was selected to fly helicopters, not what I wanted to fly.
You wanted to fly,
I wanted to fly the E-2 Hawkeye. I may be the only person in the history of the Navy that actually wanted to fly that plane.
Huh.
But for some reason, it captured my imagination. I wanted to fly that plane. And I didn't do well enough in flight school to get to do carrier aviation like that. You need a very high grades, and so I didn't do quite that well. So they said, "All right, helicopters for you."
So everybody who flies a helicopter basically is like the B team.
You know, I knew you were going to pick up on that. And they used to do this thing called quality spread, where they would take the guy with the highest grade and they would make him fly helicopters. You know, to make sure that it just didn't end up being all the guys with the lower grades. But the fact is, for carrier aviation, a great guy I flew with on Guam, he had come from the jet world because he, a great pilot, and a great guy and a great officer, but he could not keep up with the plane in the pattern of the carrier. When you take off from a carrier and then you land again, or when you go into the pattern, when you're doing a recovery, everything happens so quickly. And that this is just what I know about flying at the carrier. Forget it on a strike mission. I can't even begin to think, or in a dogfight, I can't even begin to think how quickly things happen. And, you know, there are some of us, I think I'm a rather intelligent guy, but I don't know how I would have done. But this guy, they sent him back to fly with us with helicopters because he just couldn't keep up with the aircraft.
Really?
Everything just happens so quickly. And the guys that I saw, my friends that became jet pilots, were the guys that could do like the turnaround jump shot. There was the great athletes, the guys with that kind of physical confidence and that ability to just, you know, that don't choke. Mm. I've been known to choke at pool and basketball and other things like that. And that's I think what characterizes a jet pilot. Mm. So it's not necessarily about, well, you know, all the losers end up flying helicopters. It's that it takes a very particular, to paraphrase Liam Neeson, a very particular set of skills to be a Navy a carrier aviator. Mm-hmm. So I ended up where I belonged. For sure.
May we all.
But the song, I was very depressed because I wanted to be a carrier aviator and I wanted to fly the E-2. And so when I found out that I got helicopters, I had this sort of bleak vision of my future now. And that's why I wrote this song.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're going to hear this now.
There's an hour I can narrow before now, and after that I decided to be lonely. Maybe fear or some comically overblown righteousness, more inclined to swallow me whole. Where I stand, the rebel son defies his father, and in defying him becomes him. There's a job off the Norwegian shores that is right for me, a ferry roughnecks to the oil rigs. To the local folks, I am that bomber jacket clad dirty old man. of shape, but still mercifully thin. I sing tenor in the church choir, and yes, I desire all the choir girls. In desiring them, destroy them.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Again, sorry we couldn't hear the whole piece, but definitely get a good idea of your way with words and your lyricism. So quickly, we only got about 10 minutes left. Boy, this has flown, hasn't it, Ben?
Oh yeah, it does when you're having fun.
Yeah, we should. That's good. You should keep that one.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal it.
You're going to steal it. Uh-huh. Yeah. You always say that. I'm going to steal that. I'd love to. If you could tell the story of how you wound up writing speeches for an admiral.
Well, this goes back to your question of how the songwriting interwove with my naval career. When I first joined the Navy, I was terrified that, oh, well, I'm going to have to, you know, give up songwriting. It's not going to be really a part of my life. But I discovered very quickly that the Navy is a very romantic service. And I think the military overall, like I said before, the Navy has a very robust music program. The premier bands that are located in Annapolis and Washington, D.C., those are some of the best musicians in the country. Hmm. And it's no surprise when you learn that those are probably the only jobs in the music industry that have a pension plan and health care. And, you know, if you're a great saxophonist, there's no other job that has that. So it attracts excellent musicians. And I had started writing kind of funny songs and playing them at different events in the Navy, and people appreciated them. And I also discovered a great power in that things that you definitely could not say in uniform. If you put them in song, then no one seemed to mind, and people would laugh. You could skewer sacred cows left and right and say inappropriate things in song, and the admiral would just laugh. And when I was first stationed in Italy, I worked for a guy there, and he was retiring, and this captain, and I wrote him this kind of filthy song, half in Italian, half in English, and he was being farewelled at a dinner given by the four-star admiral, Harry Ulrich. I called the front office, and I pretended to be some other admiral, and I said, oh, I forgot where the dinner is tonight, and they told me. So that's not great security, but so I crashed this dinner.
You got in trouble for that, yeah. Can't you? Wow.
So I crashed this dinner with my guitar, and I jump out in the middle of this dinner, and I put on this like wide brim hat, and I sang this this very ribald song for this guy, and everybody liked it, and everyone was laughing, and the story is that Harry Ulrich said to his one of his aides, he said, "Who the hell is this guy?" And the aide said, "Oh, that's Lieutenant Williams. That's one of your air planners," and which is what I did there. And apparently Harry said, "No, he's my new speechwriter." Mm-hmm. So after that, I became his speechwriter, and that led to a very exciting time in Europe, being attached to the front office in that way. Hmm. A lot of travel, a lot of exciting things. Yeah, I could talk about that for a long time.
Well, we have 7 minutes.
Yep.
Well, yeah, but that continued once. And once you have that, probably like a lot of professions, once you have a certain stink on you, and people learn, you were a speechwriter, it can happen again. And so I ended up writing speeches for other admirals and other members of the State Department. Mm. And it was just this other skill that I could now announce as when I went to a new command. Mm-hmm. And that having that one-on-one, it's a personal relationship, an official and his or her speechwriter, mm-hmm. and you get access that other people don't, and they can be quite jealous of it.
Really?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that aspect, because in no other way was I did I belong in a room with Harry Ulrich. There was nothing about my military career that would have predicted that I would ever get any personal time with this man, except that I could write a good speech, mm-hmm. and so that was a lot of fun for me, and I got to meet some of the higher ups in that capacity.
What did you write up writing speeches about?
Everything. So Admiral Ulrich was the head of Navy Europe, and he also had a NATO hat, which was actually a little bit higher in rank as the commander of Joint Forces Command Naples, which is a big responsibility within NATO. Mm-hmm. And so on any given day, he'd be giving a speech either right there in Naples or in Sarajevo or in London or in Paris or on Menorca. And as the speechwriter, I was also responsible for toasts and other, you know, little things, incidental comments that he might make.
You wrote his incidental comments.
Well, I,
well, that's great. That's great. Yeah.
It's not quite as it's not bad as it sounds. He was very often in a situation where he was meeting a bunch of people at once, and so I would work together with his two aides to make sure that he knew when he walks into this particular room and. You know, in Whitehall or this particular room in Paris that he knew, oh, this is that guy and his son plays soccer and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That can be really valuable for somebody in his position. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds a bit, it must sound funny to you, but
yeah. it sounds, yeah.
But the toasts are great. There's a lot of creative freedom in the toasts. And,
what are some of good toasts? Do you remember any?
I was afraid you're going to ask that. I can't. I do remember writing a joke for him. This was a speech he gave in Rome, and it was I pilfered an old joke, which I think was originally about the Pope, but it was about the Minister of Defense of Italy who was traveling from afar to get to this meeting in Rome, and so I had Admiral Ulrich tell this story about how he was on his way and he was late, and so he had his driver pull over and he got in the front. And drove at 200 kilometers an hour down the autostrada to get to Rome, was pulled over by the carabinieri. You've probably heard this joke, but the punchline ends up being the carabinieri says to the other guy, I don't know who's in that car, but he must be very important because the Minister of Defense is driving. Yeah. So, but it actually went over really well with a semi-English audience. So.
So
better than it went over here.
I'm not quite sure I understand the punchline of the joke. The Minister of Defense.
Yeah, he skipped it. He skipped it.
So he has his driver pull over and he gets in front. He says, I'll drive. And so he drives at 200 kilometers an hour, gets pulled over.
Right.
The carabinieri pulls him over and.
He's going to ticket the driver who's sitting in the back seat.
The Minister of Defense rolls down the window. I can't believe we're doing this. Yeah. The Minister of Defense rolls down the window and the guy. Mm-hmm. Gives him a ticket, and he goes back, and his partner asks him who was in the car. He says, I don't know. It must be very important, though. The Minister of Defense is driving.
I see. I get it.
I think the original joke, the Pope is driving.
Right. Yeah. In order for a joke to work, you have to go through the whole joke. You know, you can't skip any parts.
He just assumed that you knew that.
I thought that was a very well-known joke.
No, it's a good joke. I've never heard that before.
No, it kills in Calabria.
Interesting.
So I think we got time for one more song, and then we'll play out. Thank you so much, Brett Williams.
Yeah, thank you,
Lieutenant Commander, our first Lieutenant Commander, as far as I. Remember on the show.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for Kevin and Ben, two creative minds that I admire a great deal. So it's been a pleasure for me.
Oh, go on. Seriously, go on. All right. And this last song, what is this last song?
What's it called?
Wexford.
Let's just play it. It's a little ballad.
Maybe Wexford is good enough for me. Maybe I'll be waiting there for thee whilst my children grow across the Celtic Sea. Maybe Wexford. Close as I can be. Maybe Wexford, maybe it will serve. Never could negotiate the climb and curve of
life decisions.